You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Why I'll Never Make It, a lighthearted podcast that takes a revealing look at a career in the entertainment industry, featuring stories and conversations with those on stage and backstage, on screen and behind the scenes. To keep up with all the guests and episodes, go to the website, winmepodcast.com. There you will find ways to follow and connect via Twitter and Instagram, as well as ways to support and donate to this podcast. I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, and this is Why I'll Never Make It. Hello, hello, and welcome to episode 31, as well as welcome to spring. Winter ended just a few days ago, and I don't know about you, but I am so glad to put the cold months behind us and have some warm weather to look forward to. Recently, I found a blog post that first introduced me to today's guest, and that post was called Failing Our Singers. The title caught my eye, and it talks about the list of do's and don'ts, both real and imagined, that affect us as performers. We get it into our heads what we can and can't do, and this affects the way that we audition and ultimately the way that we perform. Amy Marie Stewart wrote that blog as a way to combat these expectations, and she's here today to talk about how those affect not only herself, but all of us in the way that we approach our work. She has spent most of her career as an actress and singer, but currently focuses on teaching and is the founder of Theory Works, a service that helps us singers more easily handle the demands of learning music. And she started the Facebook group, Accompanist Connection, which I have used myself many times when I'm looking for an accompanist or a pianist to go over music or play for me. So I am thrilled to have her on the show today to share her insights that not only apply to us singers, but to everyone, in front of the table and behind the table in those audition rooms. Amy,
hello.
Thank you so much for letting me into your studio.
Of course, and welcome.
This is where all the magic happens, isn't it?
It is where all the magic happens, yeah.
And how long have you been in this studio?
So I've been in this studio now for about 2 years. Now I took over the lease myself about a year ago. So yeah, I've been here at the Voice Studio just south of Carnegie Hall for, yeah, a couple of years now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good area to be in.
It's a great
Carnegie
place to
Hall
be.
Right there.
Just north of most of the tourists, and that is a huge draw.
Yeah, because most of the tourists go south,
exactly.
Towards the, or downtown, as they say
right,
in New York.
Right, exactly.
So tell me a little bit about how you got into teaching and what that's been like for you.
So I first started teaching almost by happenstance. The first gigs that I booked after graduating with my master's in opera were actually not, so I crossed over to musical theater shortly after graduating, about 2 or 3 years after. And when I started auditioning, I thought I was going to go directly into, of course, like leading lady sopranos. And the first shows that I did were more like rock musicals. And then I would come back and I would go back and sing some classical music.
How was that going back and forth between the classical world and this rock pop world?
Honestly, I think it's really instructive for singers. I think a thing that certainly conservatories and universities could fold in for undergraduate voice students is actually doing more like quote unquote cross training in multiple genres and styles.
Yeah.
I think that that's really helpful for singers. For me, I felt like I didn't fully understand how to sing operatically until I learned how to use my chest voice. It kind of felt like I had this new perception of singing in 3D as opposed to kind of being limited.
Right.
So I think it's a really great thing to be able to like bounce back and forth.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, because something that my own voice teacher mm-hmm. tries to impress upon me is that no matter what genre you're singing, the air quality is still the same. The way you support yourself, how easily you let the notes come out is still the same.
Exactly. It's all the same technique. The only thing that changes genre from genre is style.
Right.
You change the style, but the technique itself is always the same.
Right. And yeah. So for yourself in mm-hmm. bridging that gap between the classical world and the pop world, right. did you find one that was, I guess, maybe easier for you or one that you enjoyed more?
Enjoyed more, no, just like enjoy it in a different way. So in the classical world, the emphasis is totally on like music first. So it's not that you're not telling a story, it's just that the way in which that you're telling a story is through the music. Whereas when you go and you do a musical, obviously you're using music to tell that story as well, but the primary sort of endeavor is to tell the story most effectively.
Right, right. The emotion behind it, the character choices.
Exactly, and really text-driven in a way where, like in opera, the thing that tells the story the most clearly is the sweep of a vocal line as opposed to necessarily the text.
Yeah, because the composers were all about whether it's the strings underneath you or the voice itself, it was all about eliciting an emotion through that music.
Right, like the way that Mimi tells Rodolfo that she really loves him is through the sweeping legato of her high notes and her phrasing as opposed to necessarily the verbiage that she selects in order to say that to him.
Right.
So going into an environment where dealing with a conductor and really diving into the music in such a detail-oriented way, I really love doing that with classical music. And then going back to musicals, I really love taking a step back and being more text-driven and that kind of going back and forth. I really love that sort of difference.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you talk about the music world because it made me mm-hmm. think of the acting world and like stage versus on camera.
For sure.
The foundation, again, is the same, but the technique and how you present something mm-hmm. is very different.
Totally.
Based upon that medium.
Yeah.
And so for yourself, you started out as a performer.
Yes.
And what exactly got you into, you know what, I'm going to teach other people to do this?
Well, it was mainly that my friends would ask me, they'd be like, oh, you know, can you give me like a voice lesson to help me with my high notes? Or could you help me learn how to belt? So I actually found that not only did I feel that I was good at that, but I also really enjoyed it. And my prototype for voice teaching, like when I was in school, was, you know, like, I don't know if there's anyone out there who's listening who's taken this type of voice lesson, but like an older woman with like a Pekingese under the piano and doilies over the top. Like, that was not, I was like, I don't think I want to be a voice teacher. This is not my path in life.
Yeah.
But once I got the sense that in musical theater that could feel slightly less, I think, that mode of voice teaching.
Right, right. You don't have to give in to that stereotype, whatever that
exactly, is. Yeah. Exactly. So no Pekingeses today in the studio.
Right.
So yeah, I really found that I enjoyed it. And then it was like the ultimate survival job. So instead of having to, like, up until the point where I quit my day job and was actually just voice teaching all the time to pay the bills. I was breaking up voice teaching with being an administrative assistant and being an office manager,
uh-huh.
which, you know, is kind of the modus operandi for most actors. You're either...
Yeah, you find that waiting job or an office job.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, or babysitting, temping, yeah, all right. that stuff. So once I decided that I was going to leave, you know, working as like an admin and teaching full time, that became a really great way to supplement the auditioning that I was doing. There would be days where I would be at Ripley Greer at 8 a.m, warming myself up to do an audition, do the audition at 9:30, take 2 students up the hall, like in 16P or something, go back and do a call back in the afternoon, and just be bouncing between two voice lessons I would teach and then going back to an audition.
I mean, it sounds exhausting.
It was exhausting, though I'm not sure it was necessarily any less exhausting than it would be, you know, running back and forth between, you know, your serving gig or your office, you know.
True. Well, I mean, even today I had three auditions, you know.
Today?
Yeah, today. I did three auditions. And so I felt kind of crazy.
Yeah, you must. Yeah. And that's the life, you know.
Yeah.
Is all of this running around and packing in your schedule just as efficiently as absolutely possible. So it requires more self-startedness. But if you're an actor, you know, you have that self-startedness ideally anyway. So I really encourage a lot of the actors who cycle through my studio, if you have any kind of inclination towards entrepreneurial sort of tendencies, if you have a good idea for a business, if you find yourself, if you feel that you're expert in something, I think that often we're kind of taught as actors that no matter how many years you spend in the business, that you're kind of a forever student.
Always learning. This is true.
Which is great. Which is absolutely true. Certainly, we're always learning. We should never stop. But at the same time, many of us are experts in many things. So being able to...
And certainly over the years, we gain experience in those areas.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Whether it's puppeteering, whether it's improv, whether it's teaching public speaking to the corporate set, there's a lot of different ways in which you could start your own parallel career as opposed to committing yourself to the kind of side hustle or day gig where you feel like you're working a lot of hours for a low hourly rate and not a lot of control over your own schedule.
You brought up the word I was just going to say, control, because a lot of what we have in the audition room is not in our control. And so to find some outlet where it's like, I can manage the schedule, I can do this, I can coordinate this, I can control this part of my life.
Absolutely. And there are some downsides, of course, like the hardest boss that you will ever work for, I firmly believe, is yourself.
Yes.
You will probably never let yourself off the hook as much as you would expect a boss to let you off the hook. But even with that being said, you know, if you get a callback, you can cancel the student or you can, you know, reschedule the student, especially if they're actors, they understand and they congratulate you on the callback and you can make that happen.
Right.
So that was a really helpful thing for when I was auditioning, for sure.
For you, what is it that keeps you going? Because obviously, you know, we don't book every audition. And so, and now you have this teaching on the side. Is that kind of what propels you and keeps you going forward at this point?
Yeah. I mean... Like, very early on, I felt like the way that I would qualify, like, am I successful or am I not successful, was an idea of quantity of work, where I want to be booked all the time. Like, I just want contract to contract to contract, back to back to back. And if that's what I have, then that's when I'll be, like, really successful. And I think that that's a really common mindset when you first move to the city. But after a certain period of time, I think most people kind of grow into a different mindset, which is more a quality of work versus quantity. So once you shift into that mindset, and that feels like a natural progression, I think, for a lot of people, then I personally felt like it was a little bit easier to hear a no or to not be able to go into an audition that day. If you get sick, you get laryngitis. Or if you need to take like a year or two off even, which is actually the case that I'm in currently, some like chronic illness stuff has happened. And there's really, like I tell my students this all the time, so it's a great opportunity for me to take my own advice. There's no expiration date in musical theater. If you take 2 or 3 or 10 years off and you come back and you are that right person, like my example is usually like for the 5th revival of Follies in 2035, then amazing. Then you're that right person then. They won't necessarily, I mean, they may ask where you've been for the last, you know, 15 or so years.
Yeah.
And then it'll be an interesting conversation. But you can always go back to it, you know? Like, you can always miss a day or two if you have a health concern or if there's something in your personal life that you need to address. Or if you just happen to, like, especially if you're non-union, if you don't get seen that day, it's not the end of the world. If you get no, if you don't get a callback, just doing the best work possible, within your own personal abilities, I think it just helps keep things in a slightly different perspective than if you're kind of, you know, hyperventilating over the idea of like constantly being booked.
And you had mentioned in your own life that there's the medical setbacks that you've had.
Yeah.
And so what exactly happened and how have you tried to bridge that time away?
Yeah. So it was actually a little bit over a year ago. So like Christmas of, that would be like 2017. Mm-hmm. I was diagnosed with something. My boyfriend calls it Angelica SpongeBobitis. For sure not what it's called. It's called ankylosing spondylitis is actually the name of it. So
that's a mouthful.
Which is a mouthful, right? So now you understand like why he's redubbed it something much more entertaining.
Yes, I think I would go with SpongeBob as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That which as one should. So it's a form of arthritis, and it attacks the where the tendons attach mainly to your spine. And also like the discs in between your spine. So over time, as the disease progresses, and it is lifelong, it starts as like really severe sciatica pain, and then can branch into like I have it in most of my peripheral joints at this point, high inflammatory markers, that kind of a thing. And so at the end of the day, like around like 9 p.m., I'm moving a lot more slowly, which is pretty true for like rheumatological illnesses. Like you get stiffer at the end of the day, right. You get more sore. And so if I were to take a show that was 8 times a week and curtain is at 7:30 or at 8 p.m.
That's just when your body's starting to wind down.
Yes, the ingenue becomes an old lady by the time it gets in act two.
Right.
So it's not necessarily the time right now for an opportunity where, you know, you'd be in a show like 8 shows a week. So add to that, 6 months ago, I started experiencing what we currently think is probably an entirely separate set of symptoms that are all neurological. So like there's been a small movement disorder that I've developed that can sometimes flare up and be more profound, sometimes a little bit less, some numbness. So we don't know like what's causing that. There's a whole, and I was a very healthy person up until like a little bit more than a year ago. They're still trying to pull
all these things apart. And so there was no signs of any of this coming?
No signs, no, of any of this coming until basically it was happening. And I think it's an important thing to talk about because I'm fairly public about it. Like I talk about it on Facebook. I think it's an important thing to mention and to address that these things are scary but also manageable and happening even to people who are young and who are working and continuing to continue to put out work. There's a lot of barriers that a lot of people deal with, you know, even on the younger side of things, on the health side. And I've had, since, you know, like sharing some of this stuff on social media, a lot of actor friends of mine who have not posted anything publicly reaching out via email, via private message and text to say, thank you so much for saying something. I've been going through something really similarly. And feeling guilty about taking time away to go to doctor's appointments, feeling guilty about the chronic fatigue. That's finally what made me, like, forced me to stop going to auditions. I would be waiting outside in the line to go in, and everyone else would be, like, nervous and jittery and ready to go in and sing. And I remember the last audition I went in for, and this is when I knew it was time to, like, to press the pause button. I was literally pinching my left hand just so that way I could wake up enough so that I could go in and do the audition.
Wow.
So overwhelmingly tired. So I've been certainly contacted by friends of mine or friends of friends who talked about going through similar things. And I think because the industry is so very competitive and there's so many people, especially, you know, if you're a woman, there's extra, I think, amounts of women and extra competition. That there's some pressure to keep these things to yourself. So you don't want a casting director to hear that
you don't want to give them another reason to not cast you.
Exactly, right. That you're not at your 100%. But like I was just seeing last week, which was absolutely leveling and just so beautiful to watch Selma Blair's interview that she gave, I believe it was 60 Minutes, with her recent multiple sclerosis diagnosis and using a cane when she went to the Academy Awards. And, you know, she's a very young woman as well, going through these neurological symptoms that were undiagnosed for many years before finally she received a diagnosis. So I think the more that we can give visibility to these things and discuss them, the more that people realize that they're not alone, and maybe we can, you know, have more of a public awareness and conversation about it.
Well, and also that it's not a death knell for your career. Because
exactly.
I just had Caitlin Kinnunen on, who's in the prom, and she talked about her diabetes and how she has to monitor that throughout the show, blood sugar levels. And so she has stage managers monitoring that, so that if she gets too low in the show, they like, okay, you need snacks, and they'll tell her as soon as she comes off stage. So it's that kind of support.
That's magnificent.
And so she's wonderfully and beautiful in the show. And so her diabetes, yes, it's an extra step she has to take, but it's by no means keeping her from doing what she does best. You know? And I think that that's an important takeaway.
Absolutely. And, you know, Selma Blair said in her interview, you know, she said in the middle of it, even with she's currently experiencing something called spasmodic dysphonia.
Oh,
meaning,
I've heard of that.
Yeah, that she has basically uncontrollable movements in her vocal folds.
Yeah.
So she was like, you know, I'm currently going through this symptom, but the nature of MS is that it's very up and down. So she's like, I think in a year from now, I should be able to go back to acting, and I fully intend to do that. Even though I'm going through, you know, myself, all of these things, I was just in a doctor's appointment last week, and I asked them, because I'd just been offered an opportunity to go vocal direct for Celebrity Cruise Lines.
Right.
I leave a week from this Friday for Miami. I'm very
excited, right?
Very excited. And asked them, I was like, you know, do you think that's okay? And they were like, God, you know, by all means, please go and like take this opportunity to go and lie on a beach and get out of New York City for a hot second. So the fact that I'm actually breaking into a different sort of arena for my career, I actually find that I almost stopped teaching for a moment last year because of the health stuff. I am always at my lowest levels of pain. I am always at my lowest experience of my symptoms when I'm teaching and when I'm fully involved with my students. That's when I always do best. So it's a lot of people ask, you know, oh, how are you able to keep going? Like I'm soldiering on. But to be totally honest, it's actually the thing that has kept me, I think, healthy.
It's that thing whenever they, you know, whenever people are older and they're working their whole life and then they retire. And then all of a sudden they start getting sick and they're sluggish. And then, you know, so it's interesting when the body and mind are kept active and you're doing things, especially something that you love and enjoy.
Yes.
Then your body kind of, I like to think of your body as a team. It's like, okay, the team gets together and like, let's do this. Let's keep going. But when you don't have anything to do, then the team kind of goes away.
Then all of a sudden these other things can kind of rush in.
Yeah.
Yeah, I absolutely experience that every single day. And so staying active with the voice lessons that I teach, going off and now doing this cruise work, I'm very excited for that. Then I also run an online course that teaches music theory to actors.
Right, which is actually how I found out about you, through TheoryWorks.
Right, that's right.
This is basically a program for those of us, because I took music theory in college, and it was Greek to me. I understood the basics of, okay, right, key signatures and chord structures. So that was at least somewhat helpful.
Right.
But as far as like once they started to get into the nitty gritty of the theory behind composing and what I'm looking at in the staff.
Yeah.
So you try to break it down into a 6-week course, right?
Right. So there's a few installments of the 6-week course, and they're all kind of broken out based on professional skills that actors actually need as they're auditioning. So the first 6-week course, which is like the most basic music theory that we teach, but also it gets fairly involved before too long in that course, is how to learn sides or how to learn music autonomously. So the skills in order to plunk out your melody at a piano without a coach or anyone else in the room with you, how to mark in your beats into the score, and how to self-conduct yourself through the music so that way you can be sure on your own that you have learned all of the pitches and all of the rhythms and the tempos with a high level of fidelity before you then go into working with a coach.
Because I would say that the notes are kind of the basic. Obviously, you need to know the note you're singing. But I would say rhythms are almost as important, especially with modern composers. And they'll just throw in an eighth rest in the middle of a measure. And I'm like, but that's the downbeat. But now where do I? And then it like throws off the rhythm. And then you're just trying to catch up. So
well, and that's even the area in which like that first course, like, oh, yeah, it's the basic course. But we're very quickly getting into matters of like syncopation in that mm-hmm. course, which there's a number of things, like you had mentioned college music theory. There's a few things with those college courses to kind of take in mind or take into consideration. The first is that they're teaching those theory classes the exact same way that the people who teach that class, they were taught when they were 5 or 6 years old.
Right.
Because the people who teach those classes are wholesale, almost down to the number, musicians, or well, we're all musicians, but instrumentalists in mm-hmm. particular.
Yes.
So when you play the piano, when you play the guitar, when you play the saxophone, you learn to read sheet music as part and parcel of learning your instrument, and you learn it very early. Singers can and do get by for much longer before they are expected by their private teachers to learn how to read music. And they might even arrive at college and that's where their first voice lessons actually happen, because you need to wait for your voice to develop.
Right.
So you're now coming to music theory later in life, but you're being taught a theory that works really well for 5-year-old instrumentalists. It is not a music theory that works really well for adult singers, which is totally different. Singers do not have an external instrument. They don't have keys or frets or stops that would help them visualize pitch.
And we also can't sing an entire chord. We can only do one note at a time.
You can only do one note at a time.
Right?
Absolutely. So singers have wonderful ears, but it's like they have to conceptualize of music with this. It's purely conceptual. It lives totally in their heads.
Yeah.
So the first thing that I try to do in the courses is give them a kinesthetic and visual understanding of music, really get them comfortable with the written sheet music, really get them comfortable plunking at the piano, that kinesthetic sense, and then also the self-conducting, also kinesthetic. Andrew Byrne is a wonderful voice teacher, and it's very possible that many people out there listening know of Andrew Byrne. He's fantastic. And he talks about the number of senses that we use when we learn. The more senses that we use, the more quickly we're going to learn the information and the more accurately that we're going to learn the information. So if you're just relying on your ear, you're probably learning 2 to 3 times slower and 2 to 3 times less accurately than if you were to also visually be absorbing
music
and kinesthetically putting
because
it into your body.
There have been those many auditions where I'm given an MP3 or I'm going to the cast recording and I'm listening to it and they don't always sing exactly what's on the page.
Correct.
Or they take their own character choices and you look at the music and it's like, I don't think that's what you're singing.
And it's completely different.
Right.
So
right.
The ability to sit down and kind of plunk through, and then you have a choice to make, right? Like if you sit down with the sheet music and now you understand what's actually on the page, and then you go and you listen to the cast recordings, as you should, like that's definitely a step that you should take. And now you're comparing two different versions that are maybe not totally the same. If you're aware of both of them, practice both versions. So that way when you're in the audition, they're like, oh, that's so great that you did it the way that it was on the original cast recording. Could you actually do the versions in the sheet music and actually stay really on the beat? Of course I can. Thank you so much. And then instead of something like a last minute adjustment that now you're sight singing in the middle of an audition, which like that's the most stressful thing you could ever be asked to do. Right. You've already rehearsed that other alternative and you're prepared for that. And you've already kind of worked on it and practiced it. That college music theory course, there's a few, and all the other thing I was going to say about those, they're also teaching you from the perspective of classical music.
Yes.
So you might learn, for example, like sonata allegro form, which is really helpful if you're going to compose a symphony. It's not super helpful if you're going to be belting an 11 o'clock number in Gypsy.
Yeah.
So getting into jazz harmonies and jazz rhythms like syncopations really early on, which are sometimes not addressed in those music theory classes until much later at all.
I certainly don't remember because I did theory 1 and 2 as part of my music mm-hmm. minor, and I don't remember us ever having a syncopated rhythm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or ever working out of a vocal score.
No.
Right?
No. It was all chords, no lyrics. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Heaven forbid, you know, a musical theater vocal score.
Yeah.
So the idea,
Yeah, to do my recital, I had to like get permission from my voice teacher and he had to like make sure it was okay that half my recital could be musical theater and then the other half could be the artistic classical songs.
Heaven forbid that you don't do an entire hour of art song.
Right, exactly.
But yeah, so the idea of the course is actually teaching the music theater that everyone already knows and is interested in from the scores you would actually be asked to sing from in your professional life, exercising the actual skills that you would need or would find useful on the job, taught the way that adults and singers learn.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that you bring up how we're taught, because there was an article that you had in, in the blog that you were mentioning about how perfectionism kind of sets into how we're taught in college. And then we bring that into our the audition room and our careers going forward, and how that's kind of like killing us as performers.
Absolutely. And so that blog that I had written, Failing Our Singers is what it was called. That went relatively viral, I guess I could probably say, at least for our industry.
Yeah, that was the first thing that I read by you. Yeah.
That article got shared 16,000 times in the course of a single week.
So it definitely hit a nerve.
It did. Yeah. And so that, in one hand, completely shocked me. Like, utterly shocked me. It was the first blog of its kind that I had written. But then also on the flip side, I think less surprising, just given the fact that this is something I think that we all talk about with each other, you know, relatively frequently, but that no one had really voiced in a public way, I think, before. So if you can ever find a topic like that, you know, these things tend to hit a special nerve, I think. It's definitely, I think, a newer manifestation of the business. I mean, newer, you know, relative to, like, let's say, like, the last 30 or 40 years.
Yeah.
But where there's a lot of programs now, musical theater programs in colleges, classical music programs in colleges, where there's a bit of a glut. Perhaps the teachers and professors themselves they know that the reflection upon them, whether or not they're good at teaching you, whether or not their college program is very good, is how many of their students go out and book work.
Right.
So they're most concerned with your ability to book work and to oblige a casting director, that they are teaching you a list of do's and don'ts so that way you can book work effectively, as opposed to becoming a fully creative and informed artist that feels free to create.
It's that same mentality that goes into teaching to the standardized test that we take.
That's such a great analogy.
Yeah.
That's a really, really beautiful way to put it.
And so with this Failing Our Singer idea, how did you figure out ways to combat this perfectionism and this type of teaching that's kind of ingrained in us at this point?
Well, at least in terms of, like, in my own studio, what I try to do as much as absolutely possible is to approach every lesson that I teach, instead of from a position of I'm right, and this is the accepted way to sing or to perform this particular piece of music, to ask the singer what their opinion is of the music, to ask them how they would sing it. What version, if they listened to 3 or 4, they preferred. Mm-hmm. They're usually asking, you know, well, which one do you think they're going to want to hear? Like, I went and I listened to 3 or 4 different versions of Rose's Turn, and they're all very different. And which one do you think they're probably going to want to hear for this audition? Yeah. I'm like, well, which one did you like best? I'm like, why are you asking me that? I don't know. And like, well, it's Patti LuPone's. Sorry, I didn't say that. but obviously. Choosing for themselves the way to interpret something, as opposed to trying to suss out or mind read, you know, what is the current trend for this role or for this particular way to perform something, and instead, you know, even making your own version.
Yeah.
I think that invitation is, in theory, out there. Like, you hear from a lot of casting directors or teachers or educators, they say, please feel free to make the material your own. And then as soon as you get up to perform and we get down to the nitty gritty, it's like, well, the first thing's first, this is far too slow. Second thing second, this is a terrible arrangement. Third thing third, why are you singing the song in the first place? So, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, well, I think that we just threw out everything. So this is great. You know, so the idea that, you know, a lot of actors have been doing this for many years, if not decades. So, like I was mentioning before, this idea of the actor is the forever student, where they're going to have a creative vision handed down to them from a creative team to be basically imparted upon them as opposed to this being a collaborative environment.
Well, and it also depends on if you're auditioning for a new show where you're going to get to originate the role as opposed to you're now filling in a slot that's been running for 10 years.
Yeah, which is, you know, obviously two totally different things, of course, as well. But I kind of wonder, too, I know that there's this expectation that you're going to, you know, fill into a slot if the show's been running for 10 years, like a Wicked or something like that. But I think we've all seen Wicked at this point. It might be nice to see a slightly different version of Wicked. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. I don't think that'd be so bad either.
Yeah, it was interesting because I went in for The Lion King for Scar. And so, of course, I'm listening to the cast recording. I'm watching videos as much as I can. And I'm getting a sense of, because I'd seen the show live, but then I was just refreshing.
Yeah.
And so I was like taking on that kind of character of Scar and how kind of dismissive he is and kind of giddy. But then also, you know, so I was trying to put all these layers and trying to do what I had seen, because the show's been around, what, 15, 20 years now?
Yeah,
so,
a minute.
So I go into the room and I give this Scar that I've been listening to and seen. Right. And the first thing he said after I was done, it's like, okay, now just do away with all that stuff and now just sing the song.
Uh-huh.
And I almost didn't know what to do. I was like, just sing the song? Right. So, but he's mean. I've seen it.
Uh-huh,
yeah, I have to do that, right?
Right.
So then I went to a Dear Evan Hansen, which you think would be a little bit more free. It's a little newer and the music's a lot more contemporary. And they were the ones that like, no, on this measure, please take a breath here and then come back. It was like down to a science how the music needed to be sung. So
very
it was
cool.
Two diametrically posed ways of approaching sides.
That's so interesting. And I think, like I was saying before, like being able to, like rehearsing it so many different ways, starting with the sheet music, starting with it in its most literal form, you know, looking at all the breath markings, looking at all the little half rests and all the ties and making sure you're dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's. And then, so learn it that way first, then play with it, you know, 16 or so different ways on your own, so that way you can be ready to toss out whatever version, you know, they happen to be asking for, whether it's the very literal version, like in Dear Evan Hansen, or, you know, something that feels a little bit more organic to you and slightly different than what you think the vision you would have thought would have been for, like, for Lion King, is certainly something that actors can do themselves. I think that there's also some things that we could be doing differently in the industry on the creative team side of things to create environments that also encourage people, I think, to be more creative and more free.
Yeah. I was just speaking with a friend of mine about how certain rooms are very warm and open and you just kind of feel like a cuddly blanket in there and you're just like, oh, I want to take you all to dinner.
Right,
and then there's others where it's just like cold, machine-like, and you're just like, I'm almost imposing walking into the room right now.
Right.
Do you want me to go on? I don't know.
And the entire, I think, physical setup of it, I mean, with very few exceptions, we're talking about very harsh fluorescent lighting.
Which makes no one look good.
Nobody looks good. And nobody feels at ease. Like, all of a sudden, you feel like you're in a mental ward or something.
Right.
And, you know, you've got this very harsh lighting. You have a table separating you from a creative team that is seated behind it.
Right.
You're standing in the center of the room.
All eyes on you.
Yeah, all eyes are on you.
Yeah.
In the blog, I kind of put it, like, as if you're deigning to ask for a small audience from a higher court, as a sycophant, you know, in front of a royal court. And I'm not sure that dynamic inherently sets up an idea that says we are all equal collaborators in this together.
Yeah.
I kind of wonder, I mean, I put this in the end of the article. I'm not saying that I know, like, logistically if this is possible. But what would it be like if instead of a table, there was a circle of five or six chairs and you sat down in a circle together and then you did it? How'd that feel?
That would be an interesting audition room.
It would be.
It's like you walk into a circle, please have a seat, and you're just like looking at everyone.
And there's some snacks maybe and some bottles of water. And you just sit down and you chill and, like, it's sight reading, you know, from the score maybe a little bit. They'll take you through it or reading through some sides. And certainly bring in your book if there's something that they want to hear. But it's more like a job interview in a way that, like, you would go in for a job interview. You both sit at a table together on opposite sides of the table and you're two equals. You know, you would never go into a job interview for Starbucks with six people behind a table and you standing in the middle of a furnitureless room.
Right.
I mean, how exposing is that?
Right.
And it's
demeaning. And with no feedback from them behind the table, just...
Thank you.
What are you going to be doing?
For us.
Yeah.
And no discussion the opposite way of, so what is it that you need, then also the opposite direction.
Yeah. That's very interesting. Yeah.
And we don't quite stop to think about it because it's been that way for an awfully long time. Yeah. But I think there's something to be said for, like, I was thinking about, like, those earlier, like, the group in New York City that, you know, became the Public Theater.
All right.
This was a group of actors, and they took turns acting, producing, directing, and they were all one collective that created theater together.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that necessarily is possible to even go back to now, or necessarily even what we would want to go back to now. But we've certainly come, I think, a fair distance away from it. And it might be interesting to see what ways we could...
Yeah, because I was just at an audition for a play. This was like a week or two ago. And the moment I walked into the room, the woman said, "Hi, how are you?" She hugged me, and it was just like, "Hi,
oh, nice.
So glad to have you." And then introduced me to everyone behind the table. "Hi, how are you?" Shaking. It was almost off-putting.
Uh-huh.
It was so nice.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know what
to
do with it.
I don't know what to do
now. I was
now.
Like, "Hi, everyone." And then she was also the reader and the producer, so it was just like, okay, so this is the team. Okay, great.
Amazing.
Yeah. Even though it was weird, it immediately just kind of put me, oh, okay.
Cut through
all
the
right,
energy of the room.
We're good. Yeah.
Right.
I'm just going to sit here and we're going to do a side. Great.
Right. And I think, again, I think that it does start in college, this idea that there are people, and it is, I don't think that you have to be in New York City to create great art.
Mm-hmm.
Not even
Absolutely
close.
Not.
Some of the best productions that I've seen in my life were regional theater productions. However, the folks who teach in conservatories or in colleges and universities across the country themselves are paranoid about what the current flavor, what the current trends are in New York City, so that they are trying to impress upon you, you know, these things that you should do when you show up in New York City in order to please those higher-ups. And I think that is kind of the original sin, I think, in a lot of ways. If in that period of time in college, there was more time spent, like I was saying too, on like at a voice degree, like why are we only learning art song and bel canto as if that is the only way in which to sing correctly or beautifully, which is simply not true.
Yeah.
Allowing folks to explore more, to explore their own tastes, as opposed to how can they reflect back the tastes of the creative team back at them, which I think is two totally different things, is something that I think we could explore a little bit more.
Yeah, I think that it's interesting that you bring this up, because I would say the industry as a whole has kind of gone in that way. It's like us as actors, we want to please them behind the table. And so we're becoming very machine-like and same a lot of the time. Same thing, I think, with creators are starting to do that.
Mm-hmm.
What does the audience want? Well, let's just give them another movie because they know what that is. Let's give them a movie on stage.
Oh, that's such an excellent point.
Yeah. And so I think we're always trying to like just please the person behind the table or in the audience and be like, let's just give them what they want rather than push any boundaries really or try to affect anyone positively, negatively. Let's just give them the same and we know they'll keep coming.
And when things are really boundary pushing, I don't think, like, we never regret that. Like, I don't think that those shows tend, I mean, maybe I can think of, like, Scottsboro Boys was so wonderful, and it was here and then gone so quickly.
Which is such a shame.
Oh, such a shame. But with very few exceptions, I think that being one of them, the things that push boundaries and that are very different, I think have a really special life on Broadway.
Yeah, like a fun home.
Like a fun home.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, that was a huge success and should have been. You know, the things that win Tony Awards and that win the hearts and minds of people and fans for many years to come are pieces that really challenge us, you know?
Absolutely.
I think it's more frequent, honestly. And it seems so antithetical. The shows that seem the safest are the ones that, I mean, if we're going to talk about shows that are pretty short-lived, I mean, I don't want to call out, you know, specific shows, but like a Groundhog Day or something. It seems like such a safe bet, you know?
Right.
And they kind of come and go quickly because I wonder if they're almost art by focus group a little bit too much.
Yeah. I mean, because those kind of shows come in with a baked expectation mm-hmm. of what they should be.
Right.
And so you either match that or you don't. And if people are just expecting something and they don't get it, well, then they don't want to go back.
Right. And the original writers and creators, it's not like they went, oh my God, here's this story that I have to tell. No one is telling it. I know how it should be told and I can't wait to do it.
Yeah. When there's a new show on Broadway, especially a new musical, it's like, when Fun Home or Gentleman's Guide or something that's like off the beaten path.
And you know that's why they sat down to write that thing. Mm-hmm. Not because they were hired to like, well, we need to make a musical of this movie. And now you're the hired hand basically commissioned to write this thing.
Right.
I mean, we have a whole, centuries of examples from classical composers where they wrote wonderful compositions that were commissioned by the church or by a royal court. It's certainly not impossible to create something beautiful when commissioned. But I think, especially this day and age, there's a certain rawness and vitality and a story that's more unique.
Yeah.
If it comes from someone's unique and personal passions and perspective, then from kind of being a hired hand brought on to do, the newest version of a movie musical,
I'm with you. So for yourself, you said you're kind of in a pause right now performing. So you're enjoying the teaching. You're about to go off and do some celebrity cruises. What do you see in the next few years mm-hmm. as you start to step back into that audition world again? What do you see coming up for yourself?
For in the immediate term, so I'm still performing, if not necessarily doing musical theater. The time of day, the frequency of doing it 8 shows a week, the choreography, these are the things that my body, I can inherently tell this is not the time for those things.
Right.
However, what's been really wonderful is since I decided, we'll take a small step away, I've been doing some more recording studio work. So I just recorded in December, a film score. A very good friend of mine is a wonderful composer named Alex Weston. And he composed the film, the score for a film called The Farewell. It was bought by A24, premiered at Sundance, and it will be distributed worldwide this August.
Awesome.
So Michael Kilgore is the tenor soloist on that film
score.
Who
has kind of a good voice.
He has an okay voice, you guys. Oh my God, he's amazing.
Yeah. He and I did a reading together. It's phenomenal. He's phenomenal.
Unbelievable. I was sitting in the recording booth when he was doing a lot of the cues for that film, and it was absolutely breathtakingly beautiful.
Yeah.
So he's the male soloist. I'm the female soloist in that film.
Awesome.
Out this summer. And a lot of choral pieces too that he and I actually both sing on in that film. And some other kind of work in the studio for commercials and for other films as well. And I found that that's been a really great outlet to keep performing. It's 3 or 4 hours in the middle of the day.
Exactly.
With no choreography.
right.
You could be tap dancing underneath that microphone if you wanted to, but I think a sound engineer would be a little bit dismayed and would rather that you didn't. So that's been a really great way to keep singing. Plus I also sing in a band. And that, to get back to this whole idea of, we were talking about from the blog, executing material in front of a panel.
Yeah.
God, singing in a band is the absolute opposite of that.
Yeah. You're just free form. You just riff. You go.
No one gives you notes.
Yeah.
It's purely collaborative.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone in that band, many of them graduated from NYU jazz program.
Great.
The NYU jazz program. And we're all really good at music. We all know how to talk about music. We all know how to communicate. Everyone knows what they're doing. So because of that, there's no ego in the room. Mm-hmm. We just have a ton of fun. We circle up together and we make music. And that's a really, really beautiful way to spend an afternoon. I'll tell you that. So no one obviously out there listening could potentially see me right now, but I'm 5 feet tall, and I've been waiting for the day that I can bust out of the, Christine and Phantom sort of prototype. I would love to do something a little older, like a Franca
that. Some character work. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I think it's a good time to take a pause anyway. As soon as someone wants to hire me in a role where I would conceivably hold a tumbler of whiskey in my hand while performing, then
absolutely.
Then that's when I'll be ready to come back. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, until that time, where can people find you and how to, you know, if they wanted to reach out to you about teaching or this theory works?
Yeah, fantastic. So my URL is Amy M. Stewart, M for Marie, amymstewart.com. You could check out my teaching link is there and you can book a lesson there. Or also check out TheoryWorks. The website there is theory-works.com. And you can also follow us on social media at TheoryWorksNYC.
Well, thank you so much for taking time
out
in your studio for us. This has been a joy to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Me too.
To learn more about Amy and find the details and links talked about in this episode, go to the website winmepodcast.com and you'll see it all there in the show notes. There's also a link where you can help support the work and efforts of this podcast. More importantly, if you enjoy listening to these stories and interviews as much as I love being a part of them, then please share this podcast with those who you think could benefit from these conversations. As always, thank you for joining me and my guest, Amy Marie Stewart, on this episode. And don't forget to subscribe and review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. I'm Patrick Oliver Jones, and I'll see you next time.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.